BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Christopher Frayling and welcome to a fascinating collection of recordings as we explore the lost tapes of Orson Welles.
Orson, direct me. How would you like me to?
Slightly off.
To the left?
That's it. Try the other direction.
Me?
Look at me, then you'll be more upset. I want to order.
Let's take drinks and
things. I think it's very good.
That's the first thing I
think. It's terrible.
I don't think it's very flattering.
I want to order and then talk.
Orson Welles and his friend, the filmmaker Henry Jaglom, settle into one of their many long lunches with a small tape machine recording their every word. Orson Welles is best known as America's larger-than-life cultural provocateur and one of its towering film directors. His 1941 movie, Citizen Kane, still topping most lists as the greatest film ever made. However, in his later years, life was tough for him. He was overweight, in debt, and often depressed. And Orson was asked to write his memoirs, but despite financial pressures, he turned the offer down. In a way, he was already sharing his life story over his weekly lunches, so Henry Jaglom suggested they record their conversations for a possible future book. Like so many Welles projects, the hundreds of hours of tapes recorded between 1983 and 1985 gathered dust. Until now. In this programme, Henry Jaglom helps us explore their contents with additional comments from a film critic and author who did turn the recordings into a book, Peter Biskind.
For a person who writes about film, this was sort of equivalent to a literary scholar finding a lost manuscript of Shakespeare or something like that. And, you know, I sort of fell in love with Welles's voice and his mind. It's very exciting.
And we also hear from actor and Welles biographer Simon Callow.
Because that is the great truth about Welles, is that he was an experimental artist. That was just in his nature, and that's wonderful. That's what's great about Welles. And we love Welles for the fact that in his directing career, he always did things that he loved and believed in or made himself believe in.
We'll be exploring extracts from these tapes which reveal the great Orson Welles unplugged, telling us some of the things he did believe in. And we'll be hearing his outspoken views on Hollywood and the film industry. We hear about his difficulties, his attempts to get work, and his fall from grace. It's well known that he wasn't easy to work with, but these tapes reveal beneath that the complexity and vulnerability of the man. And as you'll discover, his trusting and at times playful friendship with Henry Jaglom. The pair first met in 1971 when Jaglom directed Orson Welles in his independent film A Safe Place. They hit it off. But they were an unusual pairing with very different backgrounds, personalities and ages. When they recorded their conversations, Jaglom was in his early 40s and Welles in his late 60s. They met every week at Ma Maison restaurant, Melrose Avenue, West Hollywood, for a relaxing lunch. Henry Jaglom.
Orson always paid the bill. He was extraordinarily generous. Orson would never let me pay for anything, even though it was a struggle, I presume. Very important for him to be in control that way.
And you'd meet at Ma Maison, French restaurant. Tell us about the ambiance.
Not very attractive. On the outside, there was no indication. There was no sign. And then you walked in to a little door, and around the corner was the round table where Orson sat. And the restaurant had a snobbish reputation because it did silly things like not print its address or its phone number.
Although it does appear that he used Ma Maison almost as an office.
Yes.
He directed his phone calls and his mail through the restaurant.
Oh, yes. It was his headquarters. There was no question. And Patrick was very proud of that, Patrick Terray, the owner, of having such a personage at the restaurant.
Other diners would often seek Welles's autograph on a napkin, a scrap of paper, even a passport.
Mr. Welles, no. Hello, my name's Lee Foster. May I bother you for your autograph?
Sure.
Thank you.
We've just broken a law, you know. Yeah. You're not allowed to do that.
A passport, yes.
Thank you very much. Bye. Bye-bye.
You know what I used to do in my passport? You know, it says who to notify in case of death or accident?
Yeah.
And I always said, Richard M. Nixon, White House, Washington, D.C. And I always thought if I should die, I would love to turn up on the front porch.
People would come by and pay homage to him, and quite remarkable how he turned that restaurant into his office.
You're also trying to get him back on the rails, trying to raise money, arranging interviews, press conferences, meetings. And he was once quoted as saying about you, Henry has brought me back to life. That's quite an accolade.
Yes, well, he was very depressed for quite a while. Orson's confidence was always very thin. He had been hurt so much after being praised to the skies in everything he did, from radio on to the theater, on to his first movie. His skin was thin when it came to rejection.
You're often coming to lunch and saying, you know, I've been talking to these people and there's the possibility of money. Were you ever putting a positive spin on that?
I was never directly lying. I was hustling on Orson's behalf. But I knew that my job was to keep Orson hopeful.
Film critic Peter Biskind.
You know, Hollywood is a place that corrupts most people who are successful, and those that aren't become bitter. And he experienced a lot of that. Everyone wanted to meet him. Everybody wanted to have lunch with him. But he was regarded as a curiosity. And I think he was very sensitive to that. When these conversations took place, you know, he was a relic. You know, he talks at some point in the tapes about someday a trap door would open up under him and he would disappear, which fortunately hasn't occurred and hopefully won't.
Orson Welles' legacy will remain intact as long as each new generation can enjoy his 1941 movie, Citizen Kane, the one film he made largely without studio interference or financial hassles. And Henry Jaglom, as a director, is intrigued by the making of the film, which began when Welles persuaded RKO Studio that he was only shooting test footage.
We started, the first shot I ever made in a movie was that scene in the nightclub. That's what we began with. And because it was a set that had been built for some other B-movie. And we shot for 10 or 12 days pretending I was testing to learn how to make movies. And we were shooting at it.
That's great. How much of that did you use, actually?
Everything. We just shot the movie. Uh-huh. It was just a trick. We weren't testing anything. And I made one terrible piece of casting that broke my heart. Because every face in the movie had never been seen. And in that nightclub, and they gave me a waiter that has been seen in every movie for 20 years before. He was the waiter in every movie ever seen.
Citizen Kane, although it's an astonishing achievement for a first film, and it's still fascinating.
Actor and Welles biographer Simon Callow.
As I've always said, it conveys the excitement of making a film better than any other film, which is why I think it influenced so many filmmakers. Citizen Kane disappeared from view for at least a decade. It was television that revived Citizen Kane. And Welles claimed to constantly be switching on the television at 2 o'clock in the morning and finding Kane there and kind of turning away from it with horror.
In these conversations, Orson Welles is very keen to get away from the image of the man who made Citizen Kane, and then it was downhill all the way after that.
That's a little bit rich, actually, because the person who peddled that idea more than anybody else was Welles. He was the man who coined the phrase that he started at the top and worked his way down again. Of course, it's true that Welles latterly was dogged by the fact that Citizen Kane was such a triumphant achievement at such an early age. He wanted it to say written by, directed by, produced by, and starring Orson Welles, because that was his reputation. That was the thing he had to maintain.
He was the Newsweek critic.
He was the Newsweek critic?
Yeah.
Movie critic?
I told you his review of Kane. And he said, this is not only the best picture that's ever been made, it is the best picture that will ever be made. That's the best.
You never can get it.
Never!
It's the most definitive. Not only the best movie ever made, the best movie that will ever be made. You should have resigned as a film critic saying...
I should have resigned as a
film critic. No, you should not.
Yes, that's, I think, without any question, the best review anything ever got.
Kane was the one that everybody would take seriously. I don't think he thought that that was by any means his best work.
He talks about this review by John O'Hara, yeah, which he rated very, very highly, yes, which he quotes in the tapes. It's not only the best film of the year, it's the best film that's ever going to be made. Yeah. And then Welles says, I should have retired. But he's latching onto it, even in the last 3 years of his life, he's latching onto Kane as the great moment.
Yes, and yet he carried with him the terrible review that Sartre wrote. And it was very negative. And I said, why do you have it with you? And he said one of his statements that you never know if it's true. Oh, I always have it with me. He said, they hated me. The intellectuals hated me.
Citizen Kane, it was an art house success, but it was a commercial failure. It was box office poison across America. It wasn't that well known. I mean, it's true that whenever he made a film, the reviewers did say, ah, what happened to the man who made Citizen Kane? But in the general public's view, that wasn't the case. It's true that people would have, no doubt, in the naive way that critics have, they would have liked him to have repeated Citizen Kane.
You know, and it wasn't the only film that he made. His films were all victims of studio meddling. Most of them were, but many of the other films have brilliant things in them. So his reputation is larger than Citizen Kane.
Kane was the one. He had to try to do that somehow again.
After Citizen Kane, Orson Welles went on to direct a further 12 feature films. But he was much more than a film director. He was a screenwriter, theatre producer, author, a radical newspaper columnist, and an actor who played Macbeth and Othello, reaching matinee idol status with his Harry Lime in The Third Man. Among many guest appearances, dominating whole films with five-minute parts, he was Cardinal Wolsey in the Fred Zinnemann film A Man for All Seasons in 1966. But Citizen Kane was his calling card and his masterpiece, and it cast a long shadow. Henry Jaglom, acting as Orson's unofficial agent, wasn't making much progress with producers trying to sell Welles' various film projects of the early 1980s, but he came up with an idea.
They were all adaptations, they were all classics of one form or another, and I said to them, well, what if he did something brand new, like Citizen Kane was brand new, about America at the end of the century, the way that Citizen Kane was about America at the beginning of the century. And it sounded like a good piece of salesmanship. And they said, that's great. I said, well, he happens to be working on that, which he wasn't. So I went back and said to Orson, listen, there is a possibility of getting financing, but not for any of the existing projects that you want to do, but for the one that you're going to write. He said, the one I'm going to write? And we had one of those lunches that ended with, I can't do it, and my saying, you must do it. And at 4 a.m, I got a phone call. He said, well, I've done 4 pages, but they're terrible. And the next day we went to lunch, and he had 31 pages. And again, he thought they were terrible. They were, in fact, magnificent. And we worked this way through the entire script.
After 3 months, they had some studio interest for a script called The Big Brass Ring, a political drama about a young Kennedy-like presidential candidate. But still, they needed a star name.
So I started improving Big Brass Ring. And I got a third of the way through. And my improvements were so great that I was sure that I should continue if it should ever be made. But I still have strange doubts about it. Well, first of all, there's no part for me. I know that's an immodest statement.
I'm afraid you may be right. And it's a shocking thing to think about. I'm afraid that might be.
You know.
You said that from the beginning. The one who was totally willing to do it was De Niro.
You just isn't that funny?
Without reading the script.
He's a good actor. None of the great things he does on the screen look to me like the qualities of a candidate. You know what I mean?
Sure.
That really puts it exactly as a fellow who ultimately says, got to carry Kansas, you know.
Yeah.
I really don't see him carrying Kansas.
So it was much to his shock and my horror that when I went one by one to these different stars, one by one, they found a reason why they could not do it. Redford had another political movie in mind. For Eastwood, it was too liberal.
Warren Beatty had just made Reds.
That's different. Warren had the best excuse in the world. Burt Reynolds didn't even bother to give an answer to him. Jack Nicholson was Orson Welles' first choice, and he looked most in the way that Orson imagined the senator to look. And he had said a basic yes, but it was conditioned on our ability to get enough money not to pay him less than his fee. And whatever it was, he and his agent felt that they could not reduce their price. In the end, the reality was each one of these prominent movie stars turned him down for money or for whatever reason. And that really sunk as a big, big, big depression into Orson's psyche. And it took a lot to pull him out of that one.
By the time of these conversations, it was a difficult time. You know, a lot of things went into that, a certain amount of self-contempt. By that time, he'd made a lot of B-movies. He He was making commercials, you know, which are sort of notorious, which I think he hated himself for doing and hated the people who were connected with it.
The disappointing reaction to his film project, The Big Brass Ring, and another called The Dreamers, based on two Isaac Dinesen stories, plus his long-cherished version of King Lear, was made worse by the fact that at this time, Wells was grappling with his own financial problems. The tapes reveal that, like all of us, Orson Welles had monthly bills to pay.
I'm in terrible financial trouble, and I keep trying to make a movie that will also pay me money. You see, I need to get a salary, and if I could make it doing a commercial, then I'd be free, but nobody will take me for a commercial.
Please don't be mad at me.
No, I'm not mad at you, I'm explaining to you.
Yeah.
There isn't a period where I'm just sitting.
I know that, but I don't know. I know that.
I'm working on scripts that I can make money on. I've been fighting for the income tax people for a long time now. And I have big obligations, so that's the awful thing. I'm not a free soul. I'm doing the impossible thing of trying to make money off of the kind of movies that don't make money either. But the people who have come near to anything I've done have always accepted a good salary for me as a director.
Sure.
I live week to week, and
taking care of a lot of people.
You bet. My wife and her establishments cost me $6,000 a month. And I've got one of my daughters who has to be helped all the time.
Okay, thank you.
The only thing is that I wake up sweating, how am I going to pay?
But if that were to go and you still want to prepare, and you still should be preparing the other films. But in the meantime,
be in the meantime. I would go to those other films by choice. There are people all over the world who think it's a great idea. Wells Lear. You certainly don't make a movie cheaply if there's the kind of money I need up front needed for me. So I can get paid big money for that.
Great. And so you should.
But we haven't got the deal. There are five or six people scattered all over the world who think The Dreamers is one of the scripts. Nothing. There's Big Brass Ring, there are all of these things. There are all things that if they come through, there's money up front. And
during. I understand.
But if I got one commercial, it would change my way of living. And there is a way I could pay. If I could only persuade the agencies that I'm good at it.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Why I can't, I do not know.
But Henry was trying to secure for Wells some work in TV advertising.
This company I spoke to said that they have three products that they're discussing with now. Have you ever smoked a pipe? I said, I don't
know. Yes.
Would pipe tobacco be something which would inherently offend you?
No, but you can't go on TV with it.
I said, but how can they do it in the great? They said, not for TV, it would be for an enormous print campaign, newspaper, magazine, and so on. A very high-class kind of pipe tobacco that somebody's trying to push exactly because of all the scare about cigarettes and so on. I said, I thought, you know, come with a proposition that's not impossible.
Nothing against that.
During the 1970s, Wells did indeed promote Paul Masson's wine, promising, "We will sell no wine before its time." He also extolled the virtues of lager, probably the best, and frozen foods in British television commercials. His straitened circumstances at this time of his life and his warm friendship with Henry Jaglom are both evident throughout the tapes. But there was this nearly 30-year age gap between the two, and sometimes Wells enjoyed testing Jaglom's liberal outlook, teasing and provoking him with racist comments, which nowadays would be unacceptable. These slurs often came on the back of the most innocuous questions, like on this occasion when Henry asks Orson about his memories of the Irish-American Hollywood superstar Spencer Tracy.
Tracy hated me, but he hated anybody. Oh, well, I went out to... I picked him up in London in a bar, and then he sat there at the table in the country saying, you know, what I don't know what it is, you know, but everybody looks at you and all day long he was just raging. Because he was the big movie star.
I know, but you have the image of such a secure rock somehow growing up.
What he was on the set was, what's that actor doing there behind when I'm talking? You know,
none of that comes across in the work. I mean,
to me, he does, because he's one of those Irishmen. You know, I'm a racist. But
I know you are. I don't understand.
He's one of those bitchy Irishmen.
I love him so much.
I hate him so.
That's extraordinary to me.
I know them. You don't.
Yeah. Well,
they hate themselves, and they're right.
No, come on. There is no they.
The majority of intelligent Irishmen dislike Irishmen.
But But that's just what these groups, all of whom dislike themselves.
Nothing like Irish.
There are. That doesn't make them right, Orson, and you know that. Now, I don't accept this prejudice from you. I know that you don't really have it. I mean,
I do have it.
I don't believe
it. I do have it.
He was not a prejudiced man in any serious way toward any real group. He loved to taunt me because of that. He loved to sort of show me that the right was really full of noble
There's
people.
There's some wonderful moments in the interviews where he says something fairly outrageous, and you say, "I can't believe you said that, Orson."
Well, because he,
although you get less shocked as the interviews go on.
You know, at the time, of course, I had no idea that this would ever be heard. So you're genuinely hearing my amazement.
Some of my best friends are Irish. Oh, it's really that.
So, but you're talking about Irish Americans.
They've become a new and terrible race, which is called Irish Americans. They're nice in Australia.
A new and terrible race.
You know, and they're fine in Australia. They're fine in England. They do well in Latin America. It's in New York and Boston that they became so prideful. You know, the old Kennedy was a real Irish American, you know. That's what I mean. There it is.
But his kids weren't.
They've escaped it.
I never knew for sure. Was he putting me on? Was he joking? He loved to taunt me. He did succeed in provoking me several times, which I didn't realize, into almost outrage. And then I would see his smile.
Because he's quite racist almost at times about Hungarians. Yes. He goes for the Hungarians.
It's a strange people to be racist about. He goes for the Hungarians, but he was suddenly talking about Bosnians or the toe lengths of Greeks or some absolutely absurd physiological thing about Sardinians.
He also says that he loves Hungarians at some point, you know, to the point of sex. I believe that's the quote. Sometimes it may be not so clear that he's joking or he's being sarcastic or he's being intentionally ironic, but I think most of the time it is.
Wells's record on racism in terms of actual races is impeccable. He was an extraordinarily strong and brave and fearless fighter for the rights of black people from the early 30s, when it was a very tricky thing to do and had death threats and all the rest of it. He was extraordinarily enlightened about South America at a time when most Americans regard South America as just a comic sort of little soap opera going on down there, and he was brought out the great painters of Mexico and so on. But I think he regarded Hungarians and Irish as absolutely fair pickings, you know. I mean, what the hell? It's not going to do them any harm. I mean, if you do start eliminating any possible comment based on someone's nationality, then the gaiety of nations is going to kind of decline.
I think at some level he's testing and watch the reaction with interest.
Which is what Henry wanted. He wanted to be shocked, so Orson shocked him, you know.
Yeah, I think he was a lonely man. I've never said this before, actually. And one of the things I provided him was not only company, and hopefully intelligent, fun company, but an ongoing relationship to the world, an ongoing relationship to the people he would meet through me and the other people. The time we spent together, we laughed. He had pleasure. He was ambitious again. He would get determined again. And I think the best thing I did, really, I alleviated that loneliness.
Henry Jaglom. We continue our exploration of the lost tapes of Orson Welles in a moment.
The BBC World Service.
The Y Factor seeks out the extraordinary in everyday life.
This week, the drum.
This week, why do we get bored? And what does it do to us?
On the programme today, nostalgia. This week, body hair. Why do so many people drink alcohol? Why do we tell lies? Today, hunting ghosts. On the programme this week, ageing. This week, memory.
This week, coincidences.
Burial. Debt.
Fear.
The open plan office.
Retirement.
The tie.
Silence.
You can hear every episode online. So for more intriguing facts about the way we live, go to bbcworldservice.com/theyfactor.
Now on the BBC World Service, we continue with the second part of our programme, The Lost Tapes of Orson Welles, with further revealing comments on Hollywood and Welles's unique take on the film industry. We hear him comment about his fellow directors, he's not always warm or embracing, and we'll hear further extracts from the lunchtime tapes of 30 years ago, revealing the great filmmaker as stubborn, critical and wonderfully good company. So please join me, Christopher Frayling, after the news.
BBC News. A Colombian general kidnapped by the FARC rebel group earlier this month has been released. General Rubén Darío Alzate and two companions are in good health and have been taken to a military base in the city of Medellín. The general's capture prompted the Colombian government to suspend long-running peace talks with the FARC in Cuba. His release paves the way for the resumption of negotiations. An investigation into corruption in the Iraqi army has revealed that there were 50,000 fictitious names on its payroll. Known in the military as ghost soldiers, their salaries were still paid. A statement from the Prime Minister's office said that the excess payments have been stopped. The British government has expressed disappointment at China's decision to deny a British parliamentary committee permission to enter Hong Kong to conduct an inquiry. China's decision came as protesters in the former British colony stepped up their street campaign to secure more freedom for Hong Kong citizens to choose their leader. Thousands of protesters clashed with police. The charity Save the Children has defended its record on tackling Ebola in Sierra Leone, following complaints that a treatment centre it runs is three-quarters empty. The agency says the safety of staff at the Kerrytown Centre in the capital Freetown is paramount. Nearly a month after the British-funded building opened, only 14 of its 80 beds are occupied. Local activists and a British Member of Parliament had complained that the treatment centre was taking too long to become fully operational. Mourners in the German capital Berlin have attended a vigil for a female student who was fatally injured while confronting a group of men harassing two girls. Tuche Albarak was in a coma for 2 weeks before her life support was switched off on Friday, her 23rd birthday. Germany's president said she had shown exemplary courage and moral fortitude. BBC News.
BBC World Service. I'm Christopher Frayling and welcome back to part two of our intriguing exploration, The Lost Tapes of Orson Welles.
Wasn't this a good idea to come back here? I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to go back to work.
I'm still not sure about after the greeting we got.
Something to drink, Mr. Jagger.
I'd love a glass of Beaujolais.
We're going to have the plat du jour when it's ready.
Oh, we are? What is the plat? I'm not. You are.
You don't want
so
cassoulet.
I'm going
to
have just...
Orson Welles and his friend Henry Jaglom disagree on what to eat as they ease themselves into yet another lunch together while a small tape machine records their conversations. Orson Welles had been one of America's greatest filmmakers and in his later years trusted the director Henry Jaglom to record their no-holds-barred lunchtime chats for a book about Welles's life story. The tapes, recorded between 1983 and 1985, gathered dust in a shoebox in the corner of Jaglom's production office until now. Henry Jaglom met Orson for the first time when he directed one of his performances in 1971 and the pair soon became firm friends. The tapes, as we hear, tell us a lot about the depths of this friendship, but also reflect the times they were recorded, such as here, when Welles suggests greeting each other less intimately because of the AIDS scare of the 1980s.
Hello there. We will stop the kissing.
Why?
Because of AIDS.
Well, neither of us, as far as I know...
No, but we
never
know.
You're telling me something I should know about you, Orson.
I might be a carrier.
Really?
Sure.
Okay. Not going to be us. I don't know how I know that, but somehow whatever problems we have, I don't think those are going to be...
Welles was concerned that people might get the wrong idea. The tapes, as you'll hear, are like time capsules, capturing the moment, but also revealing the great man unplugged and uninhibited. At this time in his life, Welles was struggling with his weight, pursued by creditors, and trying to make a living in film and television. Henry Jaglom, a successful independent director, was Orson's unofficial agent, confessor, promoter, trusted confidant, and biggest fan. In May 1983, the pair were planning to hold a press conference at the Cannes Film Festival. Welles had been applauded at Cannes in 1966 for his homage to Shakespeare's Falstaff, Chimes at Midnight, but the prestigious Palme d'Or had gone instead to the Claude Lelouch film, A Man and a Woman. On this occasion, It was Henry who was up for an award for his romantic comedy Can She Bake a Cherry Pie? So the Cannes Film Festival could be good for both of them.
It's all business. You know, it's creating an event at 11 o'clock at night in a 1,000-seat theatre, which will be the centre event of the festival in a category by itself. It won't be up against anything.
Can't be better.
And it will make a big event. The one thing I know from you, and I knew instinctively, is none of my films should be in competition because they're not going to win.
No. A festival film is a very peculiar animal. It's a special thing, the one that gets the prize.
Yeah.
It's only anything remotely resembling yours only gets the prize when there's such a famine, total famine,
those kind of other,
that there's just nothing else to give it to.
I know.
You can't count on that. There were a lot of my old French friends on the jury, Agnol, you know, people like that. And we've got to help our French industry, you know. What I should have done with Francis, didn't I?
Yes.
Instead of enduring that humiliation.
Yeah.
With a special prize. But there was such a demonstration against them.
That's right, That's great. That's exciting. And what one?
That first Lelouch movie.
Oh, Man and a Woman. Goodness.
I brought him to Cannes to the film festival.
Friend and filmmaker Henry Jaglom.
Because all these rumors, because he was going around in a wheelchair a lot and people noticed that.
Did you ever discuss his weight or his health with him?
It was the only subject we did not discuss. It was the only dishonest thing that I could say about our conversation was I never said to him, Orson, you're fat, and it's ridiculous that you don't do something severe about this. I was scared to do that. I never wanted to do that. I just didn't feel right. So took him to Cannes and had press conferences there for him. And the whole point of all of that was a hustle. But it was a hustle, in my opinion, for a very good cause, which was to give him the confidence and to give the world the confidence that he could do it still.
And do you think he knew this was going on at some level?
He was probably a better hustler than I am. And yet knowing, as true hustlers do, that eventually, if you hustle enough, things do happen, especially when you're working with a very given commodity like Orson Welles. And I held press conferences with him. They swarmed to him, and it was all a public relations effort.
After the 1983 Cannes Film Festival, Henry Jaglom went away empty-handed. Orson charmed the press, was convinced, wrongly, that he'd at last raised some production money, and returned home to more Ma Maison lunches and the continuing search for work. Film critic Peter Biskind.
I think Welles, he was extremely articulate, he was a great storyteller, he knew everybody, he had stories about everybody, and he had an edge. Plus, his personality lend itself to that. You know, people always call Quentin Tarantino the first rock star director. He had the perfect personality for it, and he fed it. And Welles, in his own way, did the same thing. He had opinions, he had strong opinions about people, and he wasn't afraid to express them. I mean, these days, people are afraid of their own shadow.
No one can accuse Orson Welles of being afraid of his own shadow, at least not in public. But as Mark Twain said, in America, you're famous for your latest work, in Europe, for your greatest work. Undoubtedly, Orson Welles had been a film giant. Citizen Kane had gained hugely in critical reputation as a masterpiece since 1941. But as was well known in Hollywood, it had also lost money. Since Kane, Welles had been a brilliant, wayward maverick in the film industries of America and Europe, sometimes with success, other times with cans full of unfinished film projects. Early in 1984, he let his financial difficulties get in the way of his artistic choices when he asked Henry to secure for him a rather unusual acting role.
He had me go after Love Boat. And I said, you don't really mean you want to do Love Boat. He said, it's not want to, I have to. I need the money, and you don't be a snob, and just get me the job.
Oh, they offered you, I told you, Love Boat.
Amazingly small money.
Is it?
Maximum 25, probably. Nobody was ever going to get anything like movie money. So that when Henry Kissinger comes on, they give him $5,000 for one day. Most of the guest stars on shows like this are getting it $2,500, $3,000, $3,500. And very glad they get the exposure. And they think all of that pays well. Think what fun it is.
He said, like a selling point to an actor. We've got a great band. It was the same.
That makes all the difference.
Now we're ready.
I don't like the man who plays the captain. He has a kind of New York accent which puts my ankles up.
That show stays on the air endlessly, doesn't it?
I'm unable to watch even one segment.
suddenly I was playing the role of an agent on the phone, and I got them up to a decent price, and I went back to Orson, and I told him that. And that night I got a phone call from him at 2, 3, 4 in the morning. He said, I want you to write this down. I said, Orson, please don't. He said, I know what I want to be on my gravestone. I said, Orson, don't be morbid. What are you doing? It's 3 in the morning. He said, write this down. He never did Love Boat.
Here's a man who is clearly enormously gifted.
Actor and Wells biographer Simon Callow.
There's something basically disruptive within him, because I suppose we're all a little bit like that. We all ask ourselves, you know, here I have this modicum of talent that destiny has handed out, and what do I do with it? How do I handle it? But Wells, for some reason or another, has this a fundamental restlessness about his talent that stops him from really focusing on it.
Wells certainly spread himself thin, did too many things at the same time, and the tapes include lunchtime conversations where he laments not giving some aspect or other of his own talent enough time and space to develop. Here, Henry and Orson enthuse about Albert Finney's performance as the veteran actor in the 1983 movie The Dresser.
What is good about it, just Finney?
That he's great.
Really good.
Wonderful actor.
But playing a guy, not acting it, but playing a guy acting it.
That should have been done by any of the people who really have the age and don't have to act it. Would have been wonderful with Richardson. Exactly right. And my idea, if you could imagine Michael Caine and Richardson in that thing, it would have blown the roof off.
I would have liked Michael Caine.
It would have broken your heart.
I would have loved you to play. I mean, I really...
So would I.
But God, would I have loved it.
In life, in the professions which I have chosen, my only real disappointment is as an actor, that I feel I've never been properly evaluated. Mostly my own fault for giving my energy to the production rather than to my performance. Pretending I wasn't a star actor and was just there, all many things, you know.
Why did you do that?
Remember, we're an ensemble company, you see? When I should have done Hamlet next year, you see.
Of course, of course.
You see?
I never understood that. When you're young and being modest and not wanting to push that because you figure, the people who are conscious of this are waiting for you to be Lear. That's why whenever we say your name and Lear together, you get this magical response unlike any other response.
We formed a company called WellJag. I even have a poster of one of the films that we did not get to make of Lear. And we had this wonderful British cast, and we were producing different films. You know, nobody would give him anything. So, of course, he clung to whatever somebody did take seriously. And
he's very keen to rebut the received wisdom that the rot set in after Caine.
That is nonsense, because if you look at his work, there are so many important films that he made after that. They just weren't important popular films. I consider Get for Fake a tremendously important piece of filmmaking. His Shakespeare films, I think, are...
Chimes at Midnight is unbelievably
is extraordinary.
Citizen Kane, I don't think it's his masterpiece. I think that would be Chimes at Midnight. And many of the later films are utterly fascinating. I think F for Fake is an astonishing piece of work.
You mentioned Chimes at Midnight, and one other thing about these conversations is the sort of Falstaffian sense of tall stories.
Oh, yes, yes. Wells identified very strongly with Falstaff. What's mysterious is that he regarded Falstaff as one of the true, really good characters in the whole of world literature, which is a very difficult point to make, in my view, although that does render his performance of Falstaff very touching indeed. But Wells always liked to have an bit of inside information. That was Wells's favourite conversational ploy, was that he actually knew the truth behind everything, and that if only you scratched the surface a little bit, you'd find that there was a conspiracy. He always wanted to be thought to have an original view about everything.
The lunchtime tapes certainly demonstrate that. Wells seems to have a strong opinion about every aspect of Hollywood and every filmmaker who worked there, often based, as he says, on privileged information. He's also very critical of some of the biggest names in the history of cinema and relishes the opportunity to turn Henry's head on numerous occasions, like when Orson reveals that Charlie Chaplin's comic skills were nowhere near what they were cracked up to be. In fact, Wells had collaborated with Chaplin on the 1947 comedy of manners, Monsieur Verdoux, and was disappointed that he only got the credit based on an idea by...
Then he came to me. He was being sued for plagiarism. And he said, I have to say that I've written everything I ever did. But he said to me the day when Monsieur Verdoux was running for me, you know, which I wrote. And if I put it on the screen that you wrote the story and the screenplay, where goes my case? I'll put you back the minute the case is over.
They never did.
Never meant.
So the credits.
Never meant. Oh,
so you said okay.
I said okay. Case. And it opened in New York. And one day later it says, based on a suggestion by Orson. And I've said that ever since.
Do you know whether Chaplin had everything planned out or did a lot of improvising?
He didn't improvise much, but he didn't plan the picture structure. He just don't. He always had six gag men.
Chaplin had six gag men?
Oh, yes.
I'm devastated. Chaplin had gag men? Writing?
I'll tell you my favorite story. This was a fellow who later became a director called Mel St. Clair. He was one of the gag men. This is a day when Rebecca West, Aldous Huxley, and H.G. Wells came to watch the shooting of City Lights. He started his scene in Mel St. Clair, comes into the studio and says, Charlie, I've got it for you. We none of us could figure it out last night, but I've got it. He says, go away. But we all were working last night. Charlie said, get out and get out of my studio, and I never want to see you again. So Mel turned around, as just at the exit. He said, yes, I'm going. And you are nothing but a no good quidnuck.
Quidnuck?
No good quidnuck. Now, Charlie, every day after lunch, went to the camp, and there he had the short Oxford Dictionary. On this day, he turns to Q, quidnuck. It's marked around, and Mel has written, I knew you'd look it up, you son of a bitch.
That day at the...
That day, he'd set it up for us.
So he didn't want anybody to know that he had gagged.
That's why he fired Mel to death.
Mel was literally fired then?
Literally fired, never allowed on the set again because he was blowing it in front of these highbrow grand people who thought the genius of comedy, who, like you're saying, gag man?
I mean, I'm completely stunned. It makes him Johnny Carson to me.
Of course, he was Johnny Carson.
Orson Welles reducing one of the greatest comic geniuses of the 20th century to no more than an auto-cued TV talk show host surrounded by an army of gag writers.
He likes to say that as part of his harumph, his posture of himself as a kind of grouchy, whatever that is. But the irony, of course, was that it was Orson who had ruined a great career as well, talking about somebody else, and I always felt that that was why he got so mad.
Because with Chaplin, there's this thing about Monsieur Verdoux, where on the credits of Monsieur Verdoux, it says, I think, based on an idea by Orson Welles, and suddenly he comes out and says, I wrote the script,
I know.
And he took the credit away from me.
I am not a historian. Some of this stuff seems like it could only have come from Orson. Mm. And I actually just saw Monsieur Verdoux a few nights ago. It seemed, at the time, ridiculous. It seemed that Chaplin didn't need to borrow from anyone. Mm. Then he mentions that Chaplin stole from everyone.
It wasn't plagiarism or credit disputes that upset Welles about Woody Allen's brand of comedy and the character he invariably played, which come in for particular venom.
Woody Allen's, whom I dislike intensely, you know.
Never understood why.
I hate him physically. And I have physical dislikes. I dislike him so physically. And I dislike that kind of man. Personally, I can hardly bear to talk to him.
Have you met him?
Oh, yes. I can hardly bear to talk to him. With that combination of arrogance and timidity is a particular brand that sets my teeth on edge.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Oh, can't be.
Because I would think he's shy.
He's scared. He's not shy. He acts shy. He's scared. He hates himself. He loves himself. And it's a very tense situation.
Does he take himself very seriously?
Very serious. I think his movie's short.
Yeah, well...
To me, it's the most embarrassing thing in the world. A man who presents himself at his worst to get laughs in order to free himself from his hang-ups. To me, everything he does on the screen is therapeutic.
His particular thing about Chaplin and Woody Allen, he said, you know, Woody Allen has the Chaplin illness. And I said, what's the Chaplin illness? I remember this vividly, because I'd never listened to the tapes. And he said, you know, the Chaplin illness is, look at what a small penis I have, and don't you adore me for it. I've never understood completely what he meant.
Interesting.
And I rather like Woody Allen, and I love Chaplin. I think what he said was that they're apparently modest, they're acting as if they're vulnerable little creatures, and they're in fact arrogant.
That's how I took it.
Yeah, right.
That's how I took it.
He was terribly competitive with those who had been successful in a way that he hadn't. Because what is the difference? Woody Allen and Chaplin both had long, successful careers and continued to work. And Orson didn't, and it must have irked him. Why? And so he found this answer to what made them popular.
It did seem vulnerable, and every once in a while that would come out and put some of the harshness in perspective. And he had a lot to feel vulnerable about. I mean, when you're that successful and famous before you're 30, everyone kept treating him like a genius for good reason. And when everybody treats you that way, and then the rug is pulled out from under you for the rest of your career. He was somebody who was really unable to work within the studio system. To some degree, it's arrogance. To some degree, it's antisocial behavior. To some degree, it's envy.
We can all say things unworthy of us to get a good laugh or whatever, depending on the mood we're in. I don't think he was any worse than anybody else.
Does it surprise you how rude he is about people? Does it surprise you? I mean, having written a triple-decker biography, I mean, does it surprise you how horrible he is?
Not a bit. So I tell you why. Because he said a great truth himself. He said it to Barbara Leeming, and my God, her book about him proves it. He said, look, don't trust me. Don't trust anything I say. I'll change myself according to who it is I'm talking to. I'll say to you whatever it is you want me to say. I will please you. And that is exactly what he did. And that's what he does with Henry. You know, a young filmmaker. What could be sexier than having Wells diss everybody in Hollywood, more or less anybody who was anybody or who had done anything? He would just write them off.
But Wells saves his most withering shots for another larger-than-life figure, who was the only other director in the business to be instantly recognised by the public, the great Alfred Hitchcock.
I saw what I remembered as one of the worst movies I've ever seen again on cable the other night. Hitchcock's a movie where Jimmy Stewart looks through the window.
If you think it's bad, or shock yourself and watch the one with Kim Novak called Vertigo.
Vertigo, that's worse.
Tell you what is astonishing is to discover that Jimmy Stewart can be a bad actor.
Yeah, and he was.
But really bad.
Those movies are horrifying.
I've never understood the cult. I can understand for 39 Steps.
39 Steps.
Oh my God. Which is delicious.
Oh, perfect. Perfect.
Doesn't have a kind of way. And it goes like a bat out of hell.
So again, we have a
that's
situation.
Another director.
Yes, but
I don't
there
even
you can
see the same
no,
director.
No, there's no director there, the same person at all. But I see what happened. He decided to become popular.
Egotism and laziness.
Some of the ineptitude is inexplicable.
Also, a very simple thing. It was with about the time the color movies started, he stopped looking through the camera. It's very interesting.
That is interesting because it looks like it.
And television movies.
They're cut all in the middle and they're over reverses over the shoulders.
Sure,
and
all that. All
but that stuff. Yeah.
And they're all lip-like television ones.
The way rear window is lit with those apartments across the way. And you look in and just whatever you happen to be looking at is so nicely lit. And
yes. Insensitivity to what the story could be like about voyeurism.
Yeah, it's how wonderful that subject is, of course.
When Orson and I gave a party together, a New Year's Eve party in 1983, we got into big fights with people about Hitchcock. I feel exactly the way he did. Understand, they wouldn't let him make a movie. He could have made a movie like Rear Window about that subject, which would have been devastating and true. Instead, there's this entertainment.
He refers to them as TV shows badly lit.
Hitchcock just simply sold out, went for what was commercially good, and Hitchcock's British films and his first American films are so magnificent that they showed such a great talent.
The attitude that Hitchcock's British films were better than his American films was very common. To some degree, it's just snobbery. The British films, the black and white films, the lower budget films, American films were glossy and empty. And Hitchcock is a much different director than Wells was.
Recently, Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo toppled Citizen Kane from the number one spot in an international critics poll of all-time greats, a position it had occupied for 50 consecutive years. What Orson Welles would have made of that would probably be unbroadcastable. But here on the tapes, we have Alfred Hitchcock, Woody Allen, Charlie Chaplin, all acknowledged masters in the art of film and highly successful as well, all dismissed out of hand by Orson Welles. But there are people he admires. He's keen on the acting of Michael Caine, and as we've heard, he liked Albert Finney. He much enjoys the films of John Ford and, among the Europeans, of Pasolini. And he has a soft spot for French culture and, of course, their wonderful cuisine. Politically, the tapes again reveal his provocative sense of humour and his radical past as a New Deal liberal in the 1930s and 40s. After all, Welles had worked with the darling of the American left, Franklin D. Roosevelt, And our final clip from The Lost Tapes is of Welles reflecting on his relationship with the former American president, for whom he'd written speeches and campaigned on the re-election trail in 1944, and remembering how he crossed swords with Missy, Roosevelt's private secretary.
Roosevelt is a genuine, old-fashioned American Whig.
Were you ever physically alone with him?
Yes, several
Just
times.
Physically, no one else
no
was
one
there?
No one else, no one else, yeah.
God, to me, that's so exciting, Orson. Yeah. It's breathtaking.
More often. And then Missy would come in, and she hated him when I visited the White House.
Why?
Because I kept him up too late. He liked to stay up and talk. There he was free with me. It was a release for him, and he enjoyed my company.
I know he was very charming. You said one day that you were going to look for and find. Did you ever find a letter about Spain?
Haven't looked.
He wrote that, though.
Yeah, he wrote it.
Because that's what he felt bad about, Spain.
Yeah. Oh, no, he didn't write that. That was the... That's what he said to me. The letter was the letter he wrote to me, out of the blue, and only a few months before he died, which was a four-page letter about the kind of state of the world. And I never knew why he'd written it to me.
I thought it was about Spain.
Well, that's, he said to me that. Well, that was oral.
What prompted him to say it?
I said, we were talking about mistakes that other people had made, that Wilson had made, that Clemenceau had made, and I said, would you ever comment on that subject? And he said, yes, Spain. He says there were others, but that's the one that comes back to
me. Orson Welles recalling Roosevelt's secret admission to him in 1945 that he regretted neglecting Republican Spain and remaining an isolationist during the Spanish Civil War. These tapes, which Henry Jaglom diligently recorded for the last 3 years of Orson's life, up until just before he died, have been fascinating to eavesdrop. They've given a real and compelling insight into Orson Welles' personality and his world. They've covered the central questions of Welles' life, the long shadow cast by Citizen Kane, his apparent inability to finish his projects, the perils of multitasking, and revealed the shy man beneath the Falstaffian exterior. It's as though Malmaison was Welles' final stage with an audience of just one. Now, after all this time, us as well. Nearly 30 years after his death, does the fact that we're still so interested in what he says reveal something important about his greatness and his enduring appeal? Peter Biskind.
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any question about that. He was concerned about being forgotten. I think he expected in 30 years nobody would know who Orson Welles was, and I think he'd be very pleased to know that we're sitting here today talking about him.
If you want to get insight into Orson Welles, or insight into the process of filmmaking, then forget it. All you're getting there is the insight into the nature of luncheon conversations at Malmaison. If you've, you know, got these tapes, it's in the public domain. Why not? You should know these things about people. But that this extraordinarily intelligent man was outwitted by people who were infinitely less intelligent than he was, by stupid people, outwitted Welles. And that's a mysterious thing that fascinates me.
The fact that he could still, 30 years later, upset people somehow would have given him great pleasure. You know, he's just a guy saying his opinions, but he's Orson Welles. What was the great frustration for him was, one, he didn't get to make the films that he wanted to make, and two, the other films he made were all put in the shadow of Kane. If television had been like it is now, since The Sopranos, they would have found the use of his particular kind of talent because they would have given him a space in which to work. He would be sitting in Spain or somewhere and making his film and doing all the technology he needed right there in his lap. He was made for today, and the irony is that he's not here today.
The Lost Tapes of Orson Welles was produced by John Sugar and presented by me, Christopher Frayling. The programme was a Sugar production for the BBC World Service. The BBC.